Okay, so where did we? We finished up talking about personality disorders. Is that right? Then, and I didn't have time last time to show you a brief video clip of a woman with borderline personality disorder. And so this will give you a sense of what her experience is like. One of the things that I try to emphasize when I teach my abnormal psychology course, which is a course in psychopathology, really, is the individual experience that people have when they have a psychological disorder. And it helps take it out of the sort of clinical, description of symptoms, and it puts more of a human approach on it. So this will give you a sense of what her experience is like with that disorder. What's that? It can be heart-wrenching because don't forget that these people, they remember a time, most of them, unless they're extraordinarily delusional, remember a time when they were normal and when life wasn't as hard as it is when you have a disorder. So it's sad. And also realize that some of these disorders, think of, one of the things I didn't do before. I had taught this course probably two or three times. And I never really appreciated the fact that with psychological disorders, we're sometimes dealing with what you might consider a chronic disease that sometimes has fatal endings. So, I didn't appreciate that fully until my brother committed suicide about a little over a year ago, after a long course of dealing with a couple of different psychological disorders, depression and a somatoform disorder. And I had never thought of these disorders as like chronic diseases that go on year after year after year, and then may eventually result in someone dying. So it's almost like, cancer or diabetes or any other sort of chronic long-term disease. So think, start thinking of it in that sense, and it'll give you a sense of the despair that these people oftentimes will feel. They'll go through multiple attempts at trying to find a treatment for what they have, and those can be frustrating because our ability to treat these disorders is not particularly well developed. We've got some good treatments and some things that we know that work, but the problem is some of these treatments will work for one person, but we give the same treatment to someone else who has the same symptoms and it doesn't work. So it's really frustrating for the practitioners, but it's also frustrating for the patients as they go through this process of trying to find what's going to help them. So anyway, this will give you a sense of her experience.
About 2% of the population. People with borderline personality disorder have intense and volatile relationships, display reactive moods, impulsive and self-destructive behaviors, and have an unstable sense of self or self-image. Becky, a 23-year-old college student, has been diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. In the following segment, Becky dramatically describes two of the characteristic symptoms of this disorder, including inappropriate and intense anger and recurrent self-mutilating behavior.
When I was in high school, I wanted to go to the park with my friend Sean, who was the guy that I was totally in love with for 5 years. And my mom kept telling me no. And, she can't tell me no. We ended up getting into this physical fight, with my dad and my four brothers and sisters standing over there watching, you know, and she's tackling me to the ground and I'm screaming, trying to scratch at her face and grab her hair. And so finally I'm like, fine, just take the goddamn keys. And she takes the keys and I get up and I just start screaming. I mean, I'm taking plates and I'm crashing them on the floor, and I remember I picked up a big chocolate cake and just threw it against the wall as hard as I could and just literally just went berserk. Just, you know, do you want me to slash my goddamn wrist? Because I'll slash my goddamn wrist if you want me to. You get so mad and so upset and you feel like everything is so out of control that you just scream as loud as you can and you beat yourself with your fists until you just stop and you're so tired you just cry. And then when you can't cry anymore, you just lay there and you breathe until you calm down. You don't know how to deal with the emotions that are just welling and bubbling up, and you feel like you're going to get out of control, and the whole point is to be in control. So you go and you just do the cutting, you slice, and then as you feel the pain and then you feel the blood coming out, it's calming. The cutting is a way to punish yourself for having these bad feelings, for being irrational. Because on that level, you know that you are being irrational. You know that, you know, what are you doing? So it's a fast way that you can punish yourself for being bad like that. And because you don't know how to cry, it's kind of like, I mean, when you cry, the tears disappear and they're gone. But when you cut, I mean, the blood flows and it, you know, it stains the towels that you use to clean yourself with, and it's this wonderfully red, vibrant color, and it's kind of almost like a cathartic release of some sort, like it's cleansing. And then for the days afterwards, while it's scabbing over and healing, I mean, your clothes rub on it and you know, it irritates it, and you can feel it, and you remember what happened. And all you have to do is kind of rub it or touch it, and, you know, you can feel the pain, and you remember what happened, and in more of a minor way, it just reminds you of the cutting session, and it helps calm you. First, I started with my lower arms, and then I realized, well, it's harder to cover those, so then I moved to my upper arms. And then at this point, it's just scar, you know, making scars over scars. So then I moved to my abdomen, and then I moved to the sides of my thighs.
Oops. That's not supposed to happen. Sorry about that. This computer will take over the display if it wakes up. So, and I usually check to make sure that it's not just sleeping. But I didn't this time. But we'll pick up where we left off.
In this segment, observe the pattern of Becky's relationships and note the way that she has learned to cope with her limitations.
It's like I feed off of physical contact. I mean, and I know the whole thing about babies needing to be touched when they're little, and, you know, there's that whole thing. So my feeling probably isn't uncommon, but to me it's just completely overwhelming. I mean, it's like I'm a very touchy-feely person if you're in my little circle or whatever, but I mean, if I don't get that physical contact, I just, that's another trigger. I'll start to go off into one of my cutting phases. It's easier to just be unhappy. Because to be happy opens yourself up to, you know, if you're happy about a relationship, then that person can turn around and make a rude comment or break up with you or whatever. And if I think that they're being dishonest with me or that they're going to leave, I start to phase them out so that when they do leave, it's not like you're being ripped up inside again. It doesn't matter if they're actually leaving. We can be at a store and I lose track of them. I can't see them anymore. And I absolutely just flip out. Just, I can't breathe. I can't be around people. I mean, I hate crowds. Crowds just freak me out. And if I lose the person I'm with, then it just is compounded by 100,000. And then when I find them, I'm not very nice. I'm, you know, where the hell were you? And all sorts of profanities. And then once I calm down, I apologize and realize I was being irrational, but couldn't see that in the moment.
Like many people with borderline personality disorder, Becky has an unstable self-image, and she has difficulty distinguishing between her public and personal persona. Becky is a highly articulate woman, and therapy has helped her to become more aware of the challenges she faces. She is optimistic for the future, and she seems determined both to establish permanent relationships and to find healthier ways to cope with her anxiety.
I don't know really who I am. I'm trying to find out. I know that I'm someone that cares about people. And at moments when I have clarity in my head, I want to do something with my life. Take all the energy that I spend being unhappy and using self-destructive methods for coping. You know, I want to take that energy and do something productive. But after that, it just gets all black and tangled. Confused with who you are and what you think you are. When I'm out and about, I have a face that I let everybody see, and that's, you know, it's not overly happy, but I'll smile and make the small talk and play the politics and just be very nice and congenial, and everyone thinks that you're just wonderful, that you're on this straight path and you couldn't do anything wrong. And sometimes you even get put on a pedestal, things like that, and then you go home and you're left feeling that you're completely not that person that you portrayed at work or school. I hope that I learn enough to be able to cope and deal with my own demons, that I won't need medication, that I won't need therapy, that I'll be able to use what I've learned and what I've been through to turn around and help other people. I don't want to end up being 40 or 50 and look back and go, where did my life go? You know, I spent all this time being miserable, you know? And instead of sitting here complaining about all the things that are wrong, why don't I do something productive with that energy? And I'm getting better. I'm getting better at it. I have a friend that I've had for 5 years, so he made it past the 2-year mark. So I'm proud of that.
Any comments on that? What was it?
A friend.
Oh, she had a friend that made it past the 2-year mark. Because the intensity of the emotional experience with people with borderline can be really disruptive in the lives of people who are close to them. So it's hard to have a relationship and maintain it. Yeah. Yep.
I have a friend with borderline.
Oh, yeah.
It's
sure.
Very, very trying and difficult. Very draining.
Yeah. Well, God bless you for hanging in there. Because, you know, one of the things that we know with psychological disorders is almost invariably social support turns out to be a useful coping mechanism, but also it can be very healing for the person with the disorder, and it can help keep them from descending even deeper into the disorder. And it's really hard for people to maintain a relationship when it is so difficult. You know, in a lot of ways with my brother, his family, you know, me included, you know, we kind of slow, I see, you know, I look back over time now, and some earlier than others, but all of us kind of slowly sort of backed away from him as he got more and more into his delusions. And so, you know, it, unfortunately, it's really hard to maintain that yet. So the question is, how do you find a way to be supportive as a family member of someone with a psychological disorder, a mental illness? You know what, the way to do it is, in addition to that person being involved in their own therapy, first of all, they have to want to get better. But second of all, it's also important for the family to be involved in some kind of family level therapy with the person who's who is in the middle of a disorder. Or, you know, if you can't get everybody in the family together, you can at least find a counselor that you can talk to and that can suggest some coping mechanisms for you to cope with this stressor, right? Because we don't want, you know, we don't want you to be under stress, because that's going to cause all kinds of problems in your life. So finding effective ways, first of all, to cope with the stress of that person, but also maybe some effective communication strategies that might help not have the communication break down as quickly as it will when you become so frustrated with this person that is acting so irrationally, and they can't see it, and they don't want to, they don't apparently want to change or whatever. Katie. So one of the things a counselor in a family counseling session can do is help facilitate the communication of the feelings between people, because it's really hard to, you know, talk about your feelings. First of all, once you start talking about how you feel, you suddenly start becoming vulnerable, and, you know, if the person lashes out at you, then you're like, you don't want to talk about your feelings, and then the communication breaks down. So yeah, facilitation is a really important role of family therapy, in addition to actually helping the family heal too. Right, with borderline personality disorder, I don't think there is any evidence of genetic relationships. The personality disorders in general are not all that well understood, and they are difficult to treat. So, yeah, but I don't remember any genetic relationship with borderline. Do you? No.
What are you talking about? I'm not studying abnormal psychology.
You're done.
I'm trying to Becky, right?
Oh, what's that?
What's your name, Becky?
Becky, yeah.
Um,
Yeah, borderline will respond. Some of the symptoms of borderline will respond to the SSRI classes of drugs, especially the more depressive kinds of symptoms of it. And I don't, you know, one of the things that she talked about was this cutting, right? Cutting your skin. There is currently an epidemic of cutting behavior among young college women, college-aged women. And in fact, it goes so far as there's sort of subcultures within this sort of cutting behavior. And so, you know, like someone who is actively cutting will wear a certain colored wristband, but if they're trying not to, they'll wear a different colored wristband. So, you know, so that people who know about this stuff won't trigger their cutting or won't enable their cutting, but the people who do want to cut, then they can. And it's just sort of, it's like very intensely, this is something that's really not particularly well understood, why this behavior emerges among people with borderline, but with other disorders too. So yeah, I think the SSRIs, and I think the SSRIs may help with that behavior too, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. But generally, psychotherapy is more useful for the personality disorders. Any other questions? Okay. So, one of the things you said you wanted to talk a little bit about was eating disorders. So we'll talk a little bit about that. The main symptom of eating disorders in general is that people with eating disorders, both men and women, although women have eating disorders at a much higher rate than men do, about 10 to 1 women to men, is that they experience an intense, overwhelming influence on their behavior, which is caused not because their body is shaped in a particular way that they would want to change it, but rather that they usually have distorted perceptions of what their body is like. So someone, for example, with anorexia who may be emaciated and weigh 90 pounds and be, you know, 5'5", this person looks in the mirror and they see fat, right? They don't see the emaciated person. So it's a real intense distortion of the perceptional processes. And so, but interestingly, when they look at other people, they don't have that same distortion, right? So it's kind of a bizarre experience. Eating disorders generally come in two types, anorexia nervosa and then bulimia nervosa. Now, there are a couple of new categories that may come into the DSM-5. There may be what's called a binge eating disorder and a purging disorder, which don't have the same kinds of symptoms as anorexia and bulimia, but those haven't been officially recognized, so I don't really talk about them much. Yeah, Don?
So why is it that bulimia is pretty much only in the U.S.?
Good question. There is an effect of culture on eating disorders, such that for the most part, these disorders, particularly bulimia, but also anorexia, I think maybe anorexia too, occur in a particular subset of people. Typically, the person with an eating disorder is white, which is unusual for the for mental illness. We see a higher proportion, percentage of individuals with disorders in non-Caucasian groups. Female, so 10 to 1 generally. and then generally higher socioeconomic status groups, which is again very unusual for psychological disorders or mental illnesses. And so one of the thoughts is that there's an intense pressure on that particular population to be thin, to be perfect, to be living up to some ideal that's not attainable, right? Because of a number of factors. First of all, when you live in a higher socioeconomic status family, there's a lot of pressure for the family to look successful, whatever, however that's defined in our culture, right? And in our culture, that's defined as rich, thin, and educated, probably. So, so even if you have the money and you have the education, if you're not thin enough, then that creates a lot of pressures. And so if there's a biological predisposition, for example, with eating disorders, and then you have these added pressure, these social pressures, and you don't have the coping mechanisms, then the behavior can emerge as a disorder. So that's one reason why. In other cultures, for example, prosperity or beauty among women is associated with different other kinds of body images than the one that we have in Western culture. And what's interesting is as those cultures become more westernized, that is, that they start to have more Western cultural influences in them, which include the supermodels and the perceptions of beauty, we're starting to see eating disorders crop up in those cultures. So there's definitely a cultural component to it. Yeah. And of course, if you think about it too, over time, our perception of ideal body shape changes, right? So in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, we had a very different ideal for feminine body beauty, right? So, this may be a disorder that may go away as those perceptions change, we'll see. The problem is that the people that you see in the magazines are constructions. They start out with an actual person, but what they wind up with is something that doesn't actually exist in reality. I should show them that. How about that dove clip?
Oh,
okay. Okay, let me show you this one first, and then I'll pull up the other one a little later. Yeah, right. Yeah. Oops. So this is a film that the Dove company produced. They make soap and body products. And so one of their things is they have this series of ads that is taking away the ideal of the supermodel and featuring women who actually have normal body shapes. And what's interesting is when you see one of these ads come on the TV, when they have these women who have, you know, they have paunches, right? They've got uteruses and, you know, stuff down here and a little bit back here. And it's like they're not all, you know, they're not all sculpted. It's almost like you see them as being abnormally, like, what's wrong? They're fat or something, right? But it's just because we've become so accustomed to seeing this ideal of beauty. You know, the Britney Spears thing, right? She was on the MTV Music Awards, you know, and, you know, and I was looking at her, and she obviously wasn't dancing very well, but, you know, I thought she looked perfectly fine, you know, and then, you know, the people later on would say, oh, look, her body's all gone to hell, and it's like, no, she's looking pretty good, right? So it's this really intense contrast between what we expect and what we actually have. Anyway, so this is not really an ad. It's more of a little film they produced about how we get the images that we see in the media and where they come from. Oops. So, you know, it gets to this idea that when we see images of individuals that we think are real, and then we look in the mirror and we say, wait a minute, my body doesn't look like that, my face doesn't, my neck isn't that long, what's wrong with me, right? And that may lead to distorted behaviors in an attempt to achieve something that's really ultimately unachievable yet. Without Photoshop, of course, yeah. Right.
Her head just goes like from here.
I know.
She has some like skewed vision of how she goes, that's how I really look, and all she ought to be. Your head's like this far down, and
I know, that must be an extraordinarily disorienting experience when you see yourself like that.
Am I kidding? No, it's not.
Yeah, I know. I don't know if there's ever been any studies of how models respond to these distortions. Oh, what's that? Yeah, well, you know, yeah, I can't talk about self-esteem in relationship to it, but you certainly have to appreciate that, you know, when someone goes on to into a photo shoot and they come off the street and they look like normal and they go into this photo shoot and they have to have hours and hours worth of work to make them appear the way that somebody wants them to appear, it must be very disorienting for people like that, yeah. Wow. Wow.
So it took a really long time. And also, in relation to how models feel, I was reading recently, I think her name's Hillary Rhoda. She does Estee Lauder, which is a makeup company. She does stuff for them. And really, really pretty girl, runway model. She was saying how she wishes that she looked like Hillary Rhoda when she sees pictures of herself. She's like, yeah,
so, isn't that something? Yeah. Yeah.
They don't see themselves as a real person in these ads. They just see
the
packaging.
But a lot of us who just read the magazine say, oh, well, that, you know, that must be how they look in real life. And how come I don't look like that, right? So that's interesting that they, you know, they wish they looked as good as they get packaged to. Yeah, so the money can help make up for it, yeah. Okay, so eating disorders. So now, let's take a look at the two main eating disorders, anorexia nervosa and bulimia nervosa. What's that? Yeah, of course, you already know this stuff. Anorexia nervosa is characterized by an intense fear of being fat. And what happens is this fear becomes so intense that the person will undergo all kinds of attempts to avoid being what they consider fat. Now, the other problem is that they also have these severe perceptual distortions of their own body image. So they have this intense fear of being fat. When they look at themselves, they see fat, regardless of sort of how thin they really are. And so this all combines to just create this really intense spiral of weight loss, and then ultimately body misfunction or dysfunction. So things will happen like the organ systems will start to break down. Electrolyte levels will start to get disrupted. Blood sugar levels will start to go out of whack. All of your temperature regulation goes out of whack. All of those regulatory processes start to get disrupted because of the refusal for people with anorexia typically to eat. And the characteristic of anorexia nervosa that makes it different than bulimia is that people with anorexia will refuse to maintain a normal weight. And the way that's defined in the DSM is they have to be below 85% of what's considered normal weight for their height, age, sex, that kind of thing. Now, here's the thing with anorexia. For the most part, anorexia has two components. But we talk about those two components in two different types of anorexia, depending on which one is most prevalent. So for some people, the restricting type of anorexia is most prevalent. That is, they basically starve themselves. And for people who are engaging in restricting type of anorexia, it can be very difficult because what they'll do is they'll start cutting back on calories. And the thing is that your body knows what to do when you go into famine, right? We talked about this when we talked about motivation and obesity and eating. Your body knows to cut back on its metabolic rate. Your body knows how to maintain some weight and keep you alive. So you have to cut back so severely that you're down from, say, about 2,000 calories, which is a normal diet per day, down to maybe 10% of that, so down to maybe 200 calories a day. And there's actually, and what'll happen is as your weight drops off, your body starts using fat as fuel, and once that's gone, and these people in their emaciated state still see themselves as fat, once that's gone, it starts converting muscle tissue into sugars and fuel. And so you start losing muscle mass, and it just becomes this really nasty spiral. I don't like to show them because they can be a trigger, but there are some websites that actually specialize in sort of helping people with anorexia. That is, helping them maintain anorexia. And they talk about anorexia as a lifestyle choice rather than a disease or a disorder. So they'll have, for example, discussions about how to, what kind of diet you need for like 300 calories a day or 400 calories a day, how to eat and not feel hungry that much, but just basically not eating anything. So it's this really intense cultural thing that that has built its own subculture to support the disorder, which is unfortunate. The second type is called the binge purge type. What'll happen with the binge purge type of anorexia is they will get down below 85% of their weight, not necessarily by restricting what they eat, but by going on eating binges and then purging it. So either using vomiting to get it out of their stomach so it doesn't go through their digestive tract and turn into nutrition, or laxatives is the other way that people will use purge. It's considered a purging method. So the laxatives essentially move the food through your digestive tract so fast that your body doesn't have a chance to break it down and use it for fuel. Yep. No, it's not considered purging, and I don't think it's generally associated with anorexia, but I can't be sure of that. That's a good question. Okay. There might be, they might also use exercise, and it would differentiate itself from bulimia from by the weight designation. Bulimia nervosa is characterized by individuals who maintain what's considered a normal weight, that is within 15% of what we consider normal for that person. And then they oftentimes will engage in binge eating behaviors. So it's not so much related to this intense fear of being fat, but rather that they have this sort of compulsion to engage in binging behavior. And the binging behavior may be a way to sort of create a dissociative state. You kind of, maybe you become aware of your own shortcomings as an individual and you want to escape from that, and binge eating is kind of a way to lose yourself, to lose that consciousness of your undesirable self. And what'll happen is after the binge eating occurs, the individual will say, well, I need to somehow not keep this on my body. And so what they'll do is they'll engage in what's known as inappropriate compensatory behaviors. So purging, again, laxatives or vomiting. And then what's considered the non-purging type, which typically involves excessive exercise. So people will exercise for hours and hours and hours a day in an attempt to offset the calories from the binge eating. Here's the problem. This sets up the experience of these people is that they, most of them don't want to be doing what they're doing. They don't have a feeling of control over it. And so they have to find a way to deal with that, to manage that in some way. And that's how they do this stuff. And it's going to create problems in their life and in other people's lives. The purging type, for example, with vomiting oftentimes results in damage to the esophageal tissue and teeth. So people will have to, their teeth will eventually rot because of the acids that come up from your stomach. So it's a really, extraordinarily damaging disorder. There are good treatment programs for these disorders, and they oftentimes do involve, in a severe case, they need to go through a residential treatment and be away from the kinds of triggers that might trigger the behaviors, so that they can begin to establish some normality. Anorexia does, I think, respond to some SSRIs. But mostly it's psychotherapy that's going to help with the eating disorders. Beginning to be able to deal with your own sense of self and the disruptions in sense of self. Questions on that? Yeah, that's what that new classification will be, which is, I think it's just called binging disorder, or binge disorder. And basically, yeah, it's individuals who, you know, and I don't know what the diagnostic criteria are going to be, but it's basically people who engage in excessive consumptions of food. And what they consider binging is if you eat more than normal, more than a normal person would in any given period of time, so say 20 minutes, you know, or an hour, right? Yeah, sure. Everybody does once in a while. And so when you start thinking about, is it a disorder? Because, you know, I'll do that on occasion too. Is it a disorder? Well, is it causing me occupational problems in occupational, social, or interpersonal functioning, right? And if it is, then you start thinking of it as being possibly something you want to treat. Other questions? It's about five of. Do you want to come back here about five after or so? And we'll pick up with, I think, schizophrenia.
Are you going
to
stay here?
Yeah.
Are you
going
to go?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to pass those out. Thanks for reminding me. So, schizophrenia. The word schizophrenia, do you remember what phrenology was? No, it was the science, quote unquote, of being able to tell if by the bumps on your skull, you know, what your mental faculties were like. So it's phrenia has a relationship to the mind, or and schizo has to do with a split. And so essentially what schizophrenia, the word schizophrenia, it was originally the idea that there's a splitting in your mind. Now, that's why a lot of people will confuse schizophrenia with multiple personality disorder, or what's now known as dissociative identity disorder. But what it means is not so much a splitting of personalities, because people with schizophrenia generally maintain one identity and one personality, but rather a splitting of associations and a splitting from reality. Okay. So schizophrenia is characterized by intense psychosis and delusions, which basically mean that you have these very extreme alterations in your perceptual experience of reality. So people with schizophrenia, for example, may experience a very different reality than you do. They see things that you don't see. They hear things that you don't hear. They believe things that are possibly, that could be true, you know, like one delusion in schizophrenia might be, I might have a delusion that, pick a celebrity, I might have a delusion that Britney Spears, what's that, Russell Crowe, I might have a delusion that Russell Crowe is in love with me and has been, you know, keeping track of me, and, you know, I know that I get hang-up calls, you know, every couple days, and I know that that's Russell Crowe. Well, I don't know why you had to pick Russell Crowe, but hey, you know, hey, if there's any guys that, you know, Russell Crowe, he's okay, yeah. I used to say, one of my famous quotes when I was in graduate school is, there are only two men who could talk me into bed. One of them would be Sean Connery, and the other would be Bill Clinton. But, I don't know if that's necessarily true, and I'll have to add Russell Crowe now. I shouldn't say that on the podcast. I'm not recording, am I? Oops. Okay. So anyway, so we have these intense alterations in perceptions of reality. So some of the delusions can be what we might call possible. But oftentimes the delusions are what are known as the bizarre variety, which means that they really aren't, you know, at least in our own concept of what reality is, they couldn't possibly happen. Like, you know, I'm getting instructions from aliens and what to do and how to carry out my life, right? That's a bizarre delusion. And so the most disturbing ones, of course, are going to be the more bizarre delusions, but they can also be very, but the non-bizarre can also be very disturbing too. When we talk about schizophrenia, we differentiate between what are known as positive symptoms, which include these kinds of delusional thoughts, hallucinations, and typically with schizophrenia, you'll experience auditory and visual hallucinations. The more common are the auditory hallucinations. And the difference between hearing voices in your head and hearing voices outside your head is what makes something schizophrenia. Auditory hallucinations in schizophrenia always come from outside the individual. So voices are telling them what to do, or voices are telling them how bad of a person they are, right? And they're oftentimes a voice that's known to the individual and not infrequently a parent or a guardian. And also, they tend to be very derogatory, very down. They put people down, you know, they put you down, and they tell you how bad you are and how you, you know, you shouldn't. What's that?
How you're worthless,
yeah. 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 So these are definitely voices that are commanding you, rather than just, you know, we all hear voices in our heads, or our own voice generally talking to ourselves. Maybe some of us do that more than others. And then the visual hallucinations can be quite bizarre too. You know, people or animals or even mythical animals or creatures can appear in these delusions. The positive symptoms also include speech, disruptions in speech. So oftentimes in the positive symptoms, people will talk very rapidly, or they might even start saying things that don't really make sense, but they have some kind of a rhythm to them and a particular rhyming sound, or they may repeat words over and over and over and over again. So these are very serious disruptions in perception and in behavior. The negative symptoms are generally, they're still as disruptive to the individual, they're not as disruptive to the other people around them. Because generally what happens with the negative symptoms is they withdraw from public contact. So they'll become very quiet. They may even have what's called alogia, an ability to speak. Avolition is the lack of motivation that they'll experience. So it's almost like depression symptoms. And in a severe form, the negative symptoms will be what's called catatonia, which is basically people will curl up on a bed and not talk, not look at you, not recognize you being there at all. People can be standing there talking to you, and there's no apparent recognition of any voice. So these are very disruptive kinds of symptoms. And then the psychomotor symptoms in the positive sense, what are called tics, which are involuntary motor movements, maybe jerks of the head or fidgeting behaviors, repetitive fidgeting behaviors. The thing is that these can also be caused by the antipsychotic drugs that are used to treat schizophrenia. So they aren't themselves necessarily an indicator. Schizophrenia occurs in about 1% of the general population, and it's associated with lower socioeconomic status. But it isn't necessarily that the lower socioeconomic status is a cause of the disorder, but rather possibly the fact of having the disorder causes you to move downward in social mobility. Also, families of schizophrenia, there is a strong genetic component, so you're quite likely to have a parent or a sibling or a child who has schizophrenia. So the families of schizophrenia may themselves be sort of downwardly social mobile. So that may be part of why it occurs in lower socioeconomic groups. We tend to see it start in people during their teenage years and their early adulthood. There's a blip in late adolescence where schizophrenia symptoms will occur. Oftentimes they'll happen as a result of the first year in college. We'll see an increase when people are undergoing a lot of new kinds of social stressors. So they may have the genetic predisposition for the disorder, and then they need to have added in is the stressor of a new place, new friends, new routine, and the symptoms may emerge. There's a second blip in late adulthood, in the late 20s, typically 27, 28, 29. And why that one occurs is not particularly well understood, but it may be related to the social pressures that occur in that period. There's an unspoken assumption that by then you'll have your life together. You know, you'll have a relationship and maybe be married and have a house and things like that. And when all that stuff doesn't happen, and there's a lot of social pressure to be that way, then the disorder might emerge. And that really points at this notion of the diathesis stress hypothesis, that the diathesis being the predisposition and then the stress being these social pressures and social stressors that you may not have adequate coping mechanisms for. What's that?
I was gonna say, isn't that the biopsychosocial?
It is, the biopsychosocial model, yep. Sort of the same thing, yeah. We'll talk a little, I think we'll talk more about the treatments. Basically, here's the deal. If you're delusional and you're convinced that the Central Intelligence Agency is controlling your television, and that if you don't sit in front of the television 24 hours a day, that some agent from the CIA is going to come and kill your family, it's going to be really hard to go to a therapist and get psychotherapy to help with your disorder. So oftentimes the first line treatment for schizophrenia are the antipsychotic drugs. So typically things like Thorazine, Haldol, these are the classical antipsychotics. And these antipsychotics will help control the symptoms, right? So that you can then start seeking out some kind of psychotherapy to learn how to deal with, A, the side effects of these drugs, which are very severe oftentimes. As I said, those psychomotor tics, what's called tardive dyskinesia. You get involuntary motor movements, and lethargy, weight gain with the newer atypical antipsychotics. So the side effects can be very serious, and so you need help dealing with the side effects of the medication, but also, again, adopting new mechanisms to deal and to cope with stressors in your life, right? So that the symptoms maybe don't get exacerbated by stress. Because some of the things that'll cause problems in schizophrenia and also in bipolar disorder are things as simple as not getting enough sleep. You know, a day or two of not getting enough sleep, and all of a sudden the symptoms will start to get worse and worse and worse. Social stressors. If you're gonna be going into a new job. You know, you need to have a support system in place so that you can manage the stress that's going to be associated with that. So really what these disorders, recovery from these disorders is about, is controlling the symptoms, but also teaching people how to live effectively. Because if you get schizophrenia in as an adolescent, and it goes on for years and years and years, there's all kinds of social skills that you probably aren't developing in that time. How to, you know, keep a house, how to keep an apartment, how to maintain relationships, things like that. And those are skills that have to be learned, and so psychotherapy is a good place to learn those. Psychosurgery is used in extreme cases of schizophrenia, but very rarely. And the main form has been the lobotomy, which was basically going into your brain and severing the connection between the limbic system and your prefrontal cortex. Because the thought is that an overactive limbic system causes disruptions in the prefrontal cortex. And that surgery was developed in the 1930s, 1940s, as an attempt to try to treat this disorder, which was, up till then, had no treatment at all. Basically, all you could do with someone who was having these extreme delusions was lock them up in a cage and feed them and give them water and let them live out their, you know, natural life. And so in an attempt to try to treat this disorder, some pretty extreme methods were used, and one of them was lobotomy, and it was popularized in the United States by Walter Freeman with what's known as the preorbital lobotomy, just the orbital lobotomy. And essentially what happened is he discovered that instead of drilling a hole in your head and basically using a thin spatula and severing the neural connections through the hole in your head, he could use an ice pick, and if you insert it through your, around the side of your eye, there's a very thin layer of bone behind your eye, which is the orbital socket, and that very thin layer can be punctured, and the ice pick then has access to your brain. And so what he did is he found a way to insert the ice pick here and essentially swivel it so that he would disrupt those connections between the limbic system and the limbic system down here and the prefrontal cortex up here. And he did that because he needed a really cheap, fast, efficient way to treat lots of people who had schizophrenia. Turns out that it only worked in about a third of the cases. And even then, people who had it generally didn't improve that much. About a third of the cases, nothing happened at all, and they were still delusional and still had problems. And the other third, they basically turned into vegetables and lost their personality and all of their function. But again, really, it was desperate. You know, we had all these people sitting in these asylums with no other treatment until the 1950s with the development of the antipsychotic drugs, and that was a huge change in the ability to treat these awful disorders. I just can't overstate how important it was for people with schizophrenia to finally have a biological treatment, a medical treatment that didn't involve psychosurgery. With the development of these antipsychotics then, as I said earlier in the lecture on abnormality, the asylums started to empty out. And these people were able to return to their regular, normal lives and function effectively with help through therapy. So schizophrenia, if you think of it as having a 1% prevalence, you know, we could say, well, 1 out of every 100. So if you're sitting in 4 different classes with 25 students each, you're probably sitting in class with someone who has schizophrenia that's controlled by medication. But the prevalence in college populations is going to be slightly lower because the prevalence is higher in socioeconomic status groups that might not have access to college. So It would probably take maybe 5 or 6 classes, but certainly in your college career at some point you've sat in a class with someone who has schizophrenia. Yeah. Questions on this? Yep. Yeah, there is no association with intelligence in schizophrenia. People, when we run the statistics, people of all levels of intelligence will have schizophrenia, yeah. Yeah, but obviously if you have these symptoms, it's going to impair your cognitive function. So if you don't get treatment, basically you lose, you know, your ability to learn that information is going to be impaired, but yeah. Sure. Yeah. Once you start to get the symptoms, it's a good idea to get on the medication. The problem is that once people get well and the medication, they start to think that maybe they don't have the disease and they'll go off the medication. And slowly, gradually, the symptoms will creep back in. And so before you know it, you're delusional and you don't see reality anymore. So it's a very difficult thing for people with schizophrenia to stay on the medications. And in fact, it's hard to get them to start taking them because sometimes they'll get convinced that the medication is actually poison or, you know, that somebody's trying to kill them through the medication or something like that. So, yeah. Yeah. Right. What'll happen sometimes with schizophrenia is it'll have a course where it'll sort of come and go throughout your life. And so what'll sometimes happen is a psychiatrist, once the symptoms are under control, they'll start reducing the medication slowly. And if the symptoms don't come back, then they can reduce the medication to nothing. So they can come on and off of the antipsychotics. And they're not particularly safe drugs, but they're the best we've got at this point. So any other questions yet? Sure. Yes.
Whatever.
Yeah.
But you have to directly say that you want to be committed to somewhere.
Yep.
And he won't ever do it.
Right.
And he'll go on these sprees where one time he went off his medication and he leased a car.
Right.
And he's got the delusion where he thinks he's Jesus and he needs to spread the word of God.
Mm.
And so he traveled around Oregon, didn't sleep for like 2 weeks.
Sure.
Preaching to people.
Yeah.
Painted on the car. I mean,
sure.
Glued Bible pages all over the car and all
this
stuff.
Yep. Sure, sure.
You know, and it's really frightening because he comes to her sister's house and will, like, start yelling at her and just, you know, it's really hard for the family. And so she'll call the police and they'll say there's nothing we can do. He needs to take his medicine. And she's like, but he won't take his medicine and I can't commit him.
Right.
So treatment is, like, very hard.
It is really hard. Let me talk a little bit about voluntary and involuntary commitment. At one time, you know, not that long ago, maybe 50 years ago, it was very easy to commit someone to psychiatric care. Basically, you just needed the authority of a family member, you know, a parent, guardian, spouse, and the commitment would be relatively easy. In the 1950s, 1960s, there started to be a patients' rights movement, mental health patients' rights movement. And laws were changed so that it became much more difficult to involuntarily commit somebody. Now, part of that is a function that in the Soviet Union, involuntary commitment to a psychiatric facility was used as a way to silence political dissent. So opposition and political, it was a form of political prison, essentially. And so in order to help avoid that in the United States, these laws made it more difficult to involuntarily commit. So now most of the laws require that the only way that someone can be involuntarily committed against their will is if they are dangerous to themselves, they're posing an immediate danger to themselves or immediate danger to somebody else. So for example, in my brother's case, there was no way to have him committed, even though he was telling people that he was suicidal, that he was going to commit suicide, until he actually hurt himself. There's no way to do it. And so it's a very frustrating thing for families, because in these cases where someone won't voluntarily commit and they're only marginally dangerous to themselves or others, then it's a real difficult situation. The police can hold somebody for 72 hours in most states on what's called a psychiatric hold. And so they can, if for some reason the person is becoming dangerous to themselves or others, they can hold them without charge for 72 hours, at which point a psychiatrist can come in and evaluate them and see if they're dangerous to themselves or others, and then the psychiatrist can involuntarily commit. But for the most part, people need to voluntarily seek out help in a psychiatric facility. And so, and when you're in the middle of these delusions, you don't need help. You know, you're doing just fine. You're spreading the word of God. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, these delusions oftentimes have religious overtones to them also, too. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Let's talk a little bit, I think. My computer didn't freeze up. I wanted to talk about therapies.
I've kind of a random question.
Yep.
Within the last few years, or maybe more than that, people have been made some movies. Like, there's a movie with Danny Carvey called like Blank Slate. And there's a movie with Adam Sandler who's very rough, 50 First Dates and whatnot.
Yep.
Where they, you know, have a normal life, they fall asleep, they end up forgetting everything.
Yep.
Is that an actual, like, real thing? Or
yep. Yeah, so 50 First Dates is roughly, it's not a very good approximation, but it's an approximation of what's known as anterograde amnesia, which is an extremely rare form of amnesia, which is basically people lose the ability to form new memories after a certain point in time. They can remember everything that happened before that point in time. They know who they are, how they got there, you know, their family, everything else. But after that particular trauma, usually, they lose the ability to form new memories. Memento was another fictional example of that. But again, it's a very rare form of amnesia. It's typically some sort of either physical or psychological trauma will trigger the dissociative amnesias. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, sometimes I show a clip from Memento when I talk about memory. Because memory is a very bizarre phenomenon, really. You know, it's not particularly well understood, and it can be disrupted in many ways, so it's a really strange kind of thing. Okay, so when we talk about therapies, the current model, the current approach for dealing with psychological disorders comes mostly from the biological perspective. And drug therapies are oftentimes the first line of treatment because what they do is they provide relief from the symptoms that can be either disturbing enough that the person can't otherwise get well, or the symptoms may be deadly, may be fatal. And so, you know, someone who's in extreme depression and is considering suicide, you have to use something that's going to get them out of that so that they don't actually kill themselves. So so oftentimes we want to get rid of the symptoms, and they're, you know, faster working than psychotherapy. For depression, the SSRIs, the new SSRIs work within a couple of weeks typically. And so that's relatively quick. We do have some other treatments besides drug therapies that rely on the idea of that we're going to do something in the body, and that's electroconvulsive therapy, which is used in very severe cases of depression. And it's not as bad as its rumor is, or its reputation is. It used to be bad. It used to result in severe memory loss, for example. But the newer methods of ECT result in much less disruption in memory, but they can save someone's life. So they're, again, they're really only used in extreme cases anyway. And then psychosurgery, so the lobotomy. The lobotomy is, again, very rarely used and only in extreme cases of schizophrenia that are drug resistant. So so we typically are going to look to these therapies before we go to the much more invasive types of therapy.
Are there other
there is. For example, for epilepsy, extreme cases of epilepsy that are not that don't respond to drugs, you can sever the corpus callosum. Remember, we, in 201, you talked about split brain patients. So you can sever the corpus callosum, which keeps the keeps the epileptic seizures, for example, on one side of the brain from affecting the other, and so it'll actually help people function much more effectively. Yeah, those are really the only two that there's a new form of the lobotomy, which causes a lesion in a very specific part of the brain. So it's not the broad stroke of severing all the connections between the prefrontal cortex and the limbic system, but it lesions a much smaller area that has been shown to be effective. But it often takes two or three treatments to get it in the right place, and so it obviously is going to be very painful and very unpleasant. So a lot of people will go through the first treatment and they won't go through the next one. Those are the only three that I actually know of. The most common disorders, mood disorders. The most common treatment for the mood disorders right now are the SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And these operate on the idea that there is too little serotonin available in the synapses of your brain. And in order to increase how much serotonin is available, we inhibit the reuptake process. Now remember from 201, in the synapse between the axon terminal and the dendrite, when the neurotransmitters are released into the synapse, one of the processes that gets these neurotransmitters out of the synapse is they get reuptaked back into the axon terminal. So if we can block that reuptake process, then we can keep more serotonin available in the synapse. And that's the mode of action on these drugs. There is some recent research that's very seriously questioning the role of serotonin in depression. It's not particularly understood why these drugs work. That's the funny thing about this. We're still at the point where we're developing drugs, we give them to people, they get better, and we go, huh, I wonder why. So it's a really sort of bizarre point in medication management right now. Which drug for selective mutism?
I can't remember what it was, but he does therapy.
Right.
Slowly getting better. It's pretty severe.
Yeah. So the question of overprescription of drugs. Yes, there is some evidence that physicians and psychiatrists are very quick to use medications, but they're in the business of helping people, and if they think it's going to help this person's symptoms in the short run, then they're willing to try that. I'm not going to go so far as to say that, I'm not going to go so far as to say that there aren't any psychiatrists that aren't over-medicating. There are. But I think for the most part, they're sensitive to the issues of the medication, to the side effects, to the problems of them. And oftentimes what it'll be sort of a trial of the medication to see if it's going to help somebody. Because again, some people respond to the medication, some people don't. And if it doesn't help, then they'll take them off the medication. If it does, then they might continue it. So
my issue was that he's 6 years old.
Okay, yeah. So there's an increasingly large use of psychotropic medications for disorders in very young children, as early as 1 or 2 years old, that they're starting to use things like antipsychotic drugs, which have never been, they weren't ever developed for pediatric patients, and they haven't effectively been tested in pediatric populations. And so it's not particularly well known what the effects of these drugs on long-term development is. So I would be very hesitant to use powerful psychotropic medications in very young children. Unless there's some real intense disruption in behavior that's causing other people a lot of distress or causing them to not be able to function well because the long-term effects aren't understood at all. The MAOIs are sometimes used, and remember that in the synapse here you've got these enzymes, and one of them enzymes that's sitting in the synapse in the interstitial fluid is monoamine oxidase. And the job of monoamine oxidase is to oxidize, to break down the bonds of the neurotransmitters. And so if you don't have, if you have too much monoamine oxidase going on in the synapse, then it's going to break down too much of the serotonin. It's not going to activate the receptors enough. So what we want to do is we want to inhibit the action of monoamine oxidase so that we keep more serotonin in the synapse. The MAOIs also work on norepinephrine, and so they're sometimes more useful in particular mood disorders where there may be a norepinephrine problem. And then the third class of drugs that's typically used with mood disorders, but only in bipolar or manic patients, is lithium. Lithium has been used for a long, long time. It is a relatively safe drug, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't cause side effects that are really undesirable and cause people really not to take that drug. I'm sorry? Yeah, I don't know the biochemical action of lithium. It's beyond my ability to sort of delve into it without a real good knowledge of biochemistry. Yeah. Yeah. Did you look up Jameson's textbook on bipolar? That might have a better explanation of it. Yeah. Anxiety disorders typically will respond well to what are called the anti-anxiolytics. The benzodiazepine class is oftentimes the first choice for anxiety disorders. So you might have heard of Valium. You might have heard of a drug called Klonopin. These are examples of benzodiazepines. The problem with the benzodiazepines is that they do have a tolerance potential, so you need to start taking more and more of it to get the same effects. They also have a dependency characteristic, so when you come off of them, you'll experience some withdrawal from them, and that withdrawal can be really unpleasant. What class are Quaaludes in? You know, Quaaludes may be an anticonvulsant drug, but I'm not sure. They're a street drug that are used as sort of, essentially what they do is they slow everything down. They really slow down your central nervous system. For anti-anxiety? I don't remember. Yeah, they may have been. The drugs that were formerly used for anti-anxiety were the barbiturate class of drugs. And it might be in the barbiturates. And so, but the problem with those is they have a much worse tolerance and dependency profile than the benzodiazepines. The benzodiazepines are comparatively safe, but they both can have tolerance and dependency. When we start seeing psychosis and delusions, then we start reaching for the antipsychotic drugs. The classical antipsychotics are what are known as neuroleptic drugs. So Thorazine, Haldol, I can't remember the names of the others. And these operate to moderate levels of dopamine and serotonin. Mostly, the classical antipsychotics work on the dopamine class of neurotransmitters. The newer, what are called atypical antipsychotics, operate more on the serotonin class of neurotransmitters. So really, the biomedical approach has been to try to figure out which drugs help which disorders, and then see what kinds of effects they have on neurotransmitters. So it's really a neurotransmitter-focused intervention. Okay, so once we've got the symptoms under control with these drugs, then we can start looking towards psychotherapy to try to address any underlying problems that may be exacerbating the disorders or the symptoms. And remember, the granddaddy of psychotherapy is the psychodynamic or psychoanalytic approach. Freud said, all I have to do is lay you down on a couch, let you free associate until you stop talking, and then I know where the repression is, and I can go in and start figuring out, you know, what the problem is. The problem with psychoanalysis in a contemporary model is that it takes a long time. It'll take years and years and years and years of usually twice a week therapy for an hour each time. And insurance companies really don't like to pay for therapy like that. Following the psychodynamic approach was the humanistic therapies. Carl Rogers called his therapy client-centered therapy. And the idea with the humanistic approach, remember, is to try to help people reach their highest possible potential, their self-actualization. And Rogers proposed that if we give people this unconditional positive regard, we can encourage them to get well by getting better, you know, becoming more self-actualized. So that involves basically not seeing the individual as worthy regardless of their behaviors. So no matter how disturbing their behaviors is, they're still a worthwhile human being and they still want to progress to self-actualization. what's known as active listening also came out of this approach, but I'm not going to talk about that because I'm short on time. The current models for therapy are behavioral therapy, so using classical conditioning to help people, typically for phobias and what are known as paraphilias. Paraphilias are basically sexual fetishes. So an individual may not be able to be sexually active without a particular object being in contact with, you know, a lacy garment or a shoe, or oftentimes they're non-human objects. So it can be very disruptive, and those paraphilias are, and phobias are oftentimes conditioned classically in childhood. So we can use classical conditioning and exposure therapy to undo that conditioning. Operant conditioning is also used, but typically in facilities where they use what are called token economies. So they encourage the behaviors they want by giving rewards, these token rewards, and then they can trade these tokens in for things that they want. Cognitive therapy basically involves questioning people's beliefs. You know, they come in and say, I'm worthless, my life is meaningless. And the therapist says, oh, really? Tell me about some of the people in your life that think your life isn't worthless or does have meaning. And so it's an attempt to try to, you know, basically appeal to the person's rationality. But of course, that's not going to work very well when they're in the middle of psychosis. So typically, we have to use the medications to relieve the psychosis symptoms, and then we can deal with those underlying thoughts. Cognitive behavioral therapy was developed by Aaron Beck, and it sort of combines behavioral therapy and cognitive therapy. So they use behavior modification in an attempt to change the beliefs that the person has. And then they use cognitive therapy to try to change the behaviors that the person has. So it gets people, for example, to go out if they're, for example, if they're experiencing depression and they feel like they can't go out in public, it gets them to go out in public. It provides rewards for them to do that. And that's an attempt to kind of change their beliefs that they can't go out in public. And then they also use cognitive therapy to try to move someone closer to that. Finally, family therapy. So these disorders can be very disruptive to family systems, and we have to sometimes address the problems in the family, which may be either exacerbating the disorders or may be caused by the disorders. So family therapy is extraordinarily important to develop these social support networks within the families. All right, we don't have time to talk about anything else. There's not much else I would talk about anyway. I forgot to make copies of your study guide. There's a study guide available for download. I was going to make copies and bring them today, but I forgot. You should be ready for your exam. Yep, question? Probably, at least to the extent that your textbook covers it. Yeah. You know, my lectures are really just supports for the textbook, so yeah. So I'll see you, is it Monday? Yeah. Yeah, study well. Oh yeah, Tuesday. I have an answer.